Hey.
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 Welcome to Drunk Queer Bitches Talk Books. I'm your host today, Tony, and I'm joined by our usual bitches. I'm Tony, the nerdy one.
I'm Adam, the sassy one.
I'm Jared, the quirky one.
And I'm Erin, the lesbian.
The hors d'oeuvres are laid out, and the mimosas have been poured. This month, we read a science fiction book. To that end, we selected Consider Phlebas by Ian M. Banks. Spoiler warning, since this will be a discussion of the book, there will be discussion of the plot, potentially all the way up to the end of the story. So, spoiler warning, pause, read it, come back, and listen to our take. Since this is our first episode, I'm going to turn you over to Jared and Erin to discuss the origin of our podcast.
All right, so for the past 2 years, I have been doing the Pop Sugar Reading Challenge, which was a lot of fun, but also super time-consuming, and did not leave me a lot of time to read the books that I actually wanted to listen to.
For the past 2 years, I've been failing at the Pop Sugar Challenge.
That is true. Every year, I was told that I would have compatriots, and every year they all bowed out on me, so I was the ultimate victor. But anyway, so I was discussing it with Jared one day, and he decided that, you know, maybe instead of doing the reading challenge every year, that he and I could just read one book a month and kind of get together and talk about it. And then that was mentioned to Adam, and then that was mentioned to Tony, and somehow it turned into this shit show. Jared, would you have anything to add?
I mean, you pretty much got everything. Basically, what happened is you and I got together. We wanted to just goof around and talk about books. We decided, hey, let's be professional about it, and we grabbed a couple more gays and decided to record.
And became completely unprofessional. And back to probably, you in the studio.
Okay, so if you're not familiar with the Pop Sugar Challenge, the idea is it gives you a list of 40 books, and each one is a different
40 topics.
Right, 40 topics.
Unless you're a go-getter, and then they give you one every week of the year.
Yeah, like the 2017, the 2017 last year, they added an advanced reading section of 12 extra books, so 52, one for each week. Yeah, that did not happen. I got my 40, and then I said, fuck it.
Side note, I failed that too.
So it's a list of different topics, different categories, different genres and subgenres. So we wanted to play with that for the idea of the podcast. We wanted to take a list, create a list of categories, and then find books to apply to it. Largely for the same reasons the Pop Sugar Challenge, to get us out of our comfort zone. Because we all have our niche genres, our niche topics. So we wanted to expose each other to different kinds of reading and literature.
Some of us, like, haven't read a book in a year or two, so...
And some of us are reading 5 books at once. Hey!
And some of us have a pile that will never be gotten to.
So, to that end, we made a list of topics, subgenres, genres, and the first one we had since January 2nd is Science Fiction Day, based on the birthday of Isaac Asimov, as it should be. We decided to go with a science fiction book for our first month. And so since I'm the resident science fiction nerd of the group, that it was handed over to me to select a book for this month. So I selected Consider Phlebas by Ian M. Banks. I picked this book because I've read one other book in the series, and I enjoyed that one, and I was really curious about what else has gone on in this series, because what I read was the third one in the series, Use of Weapons, and it was really interesting based on its structure. It was kind of weird, so I was curious what another book set in the same universe was going to be like, and since I wanted to expose you guys to some kind of space opera story, I decided to grab the first book that he wrote in the Culture series so that we could read it all and discuss that.
Well, actually, we voted, and if you'll remember...
This is a democracy.
Yes, okay. Aaron voted for a space opera.
Okay, if you want to be technical... Well, right. I asked you guys to narrow down a more specific subgenre, because I said, well, I've never read a... Cyberpunk.
That
yeah.
was my vote.
I was like, I've never really read a good, like, a classic cyberpunk, so I'm like, we could do a space opera or a cyberpunk, and you guys pick space opera, so, and I had Consider Phlebas already selected as the space opera, so. Okay, so we wrote a synopsis of the story, but it's 4 pages long, so we're going to put that on our social media so you guys can read it if you want to read it over, just the summary, if you don't get a chance to read the full novel before you want to listen to our podcast. So I'm going to just read for you the Goodreads synopsis, just so you have a good rundown of what takes place in the story. The war raged across the galaxy. Billions had died, billions more were doomed. Moons, planets, the very stars themselves faced destruction. Cold-blooded, brutal, and worse, random. The Adirans fought for their faith, the culture for its moral right to exist. principles were at stake. There could be no surrender. Within the cosmic conflict, an individual crusade. Deep within the fabled labyrinth on a buried world, a planet of the dead prescribed to mortals, lay a fugitive mind. Both the culture and the adherents sought it, and it was the fate of Horza, the Changer, and his motley crew of unpredictable mercenaries, human and machine, to find it, and with it, their own destruction.
Why will?
So, the story takes place in the, it's part of the culture series, so it's this shared universe that is tied together with the idea of the culture society. The culture is a enormous civilization populated mostly by humans and sentient drones, and it's administered and controlled by minds, which are these massive AIs that control everything and are brilliant beyond all reason. Although it's implied that there are still some humans that are a little bit, not necessarily smarter, but can reach better conclusions.
It's not implied, it's not what it's stated.
Huh?
And it is. I said it's,
well, it's stated, but there's still some ambiguity about it, because they said it still could just be chance. Because it said there's so many people in the culture.
Statistically, yeah.
Yeah, it says there are over 18 trillion humans in the culture. And so, like, with the chance, it's saying that since there are so many people in the culture, if you just flip a coin randomly...
Enough times.
Yeah, enough, like, some subset of those people will still get heads for a very long amount of time. Mm-hmm. So there are human beings that might just always, by chance, be right.
It's the monkeys writing Shakespeare theory, basically.
Right. There's the culture. So that shows you just how big the culture is that there's this understanding that certain events, even certain unlikely events, will eventually happen in the culture. It's just so large. And so there are these referrer characters. We only meet one of them in the story, who just get asked questions on, like, their take on whatever problem the culture is trying to solve at the time. But like I said, there's trillions of human beings. It doesn't say how many drones there are, but it says there's hundreds of thousands of these mind AIs that do everything from, like, run the cities to the starships. The culture is described as kind of amorphous and vague. It's it kind of actively resists being defined kind of on paper, which is strange, because some of the characters, like, where's the little drone that you meet halfway through?
Unaha Clasp.
Yeah,
my
that
favorite.
One. Because he talks about the legality of his existence. Like, he wants to join and be an official member of the culture. He's still paying off a generational debt.
A creation debt.
So that sounds like there's a lot of legality in the culture. But at the same time, they talk about how the culture is kind of anarchy-ish and kind of lawless at the same time. But because this society is so far advanced that there's really no needs, that you can kind of be anarchy and lawless without...
Anarchic.
I actually wrote anarchic, but that sounds strange when I tried to say it. Because the society is so advanced and it's post-scarcity, you can be anarchic and lawless without any real consequences. So one of the major themes in the culture series is the idea of interference. Because the culture has taken it upon themselves to be, like, the moralistic people in the universe who are interfering with the smaller societies to try to help them. And so that's a major theme in both the book we just read and the book I read before, The Use of Weapons, is it a really a good thing that the culture is interfering in these other societies? To that end, they have what would be, I guess, their equivalent of a government department, if you can have a government department in something as non-defined as the culture, called Contact, which is all about, it's their foreign relations, basically, their foreign relations department, that mediates the interactions with these other societies, and they have a subset of Contact called Special Circumstances, which is basically their Black Ops department. And they're the ones that, they're the Special Circumstances agents who will do the dirty work that the culture doesn't want to admit happens. But the culture is mostly made up of humans, which is weird.
So that's something I would say, I would stop using the word humans, that drove me crazy, and I think you said the same thing. They're humanoids.
They're humanoids, yeah. The
well,
author,
I used human-esque, but yeah.
The narrator uses the word human synonymously with humanoid.
Actually, one of my first notes when I was doing the book was, like, questioning what exactly Horza was, because I was like, so are Changers human? Or are they just considered human? And it got explained later, but,
right.
Like, it was really confusing at the beginning.
Yeah, like, when they were like, oh, Yelsin has down on her, I was like, what? Like,
which I used in my lesbian subtext. I was like, oh, body hair, feminism,
yeah,
got
so,
this.
So human in this series is, like, an archetype. And
so
there
is it
are
basically
variations
anything that's
on
not
human.
A...
That's got, like,
not
a petalish...
Yeah, anything that has two arms, two legs...
And it's not a
two
machine.
Eyes, a nose, and a mouth, basically.
Okay.
And even that, there's some
Which
ambiguity
clear,
about.
It's clear later in the book, but at the beginning, I was really confused about
that. Yeah, that really confused me when I read the the other book, because it does the same thing, and they just call him straight up human. And I'm reading it, like, there's no mention of Earth at all, and I'm like, there's no discussion of humans as we know them.
Right.
So, yeah, to put it in that larger setting, it's mentioned towards the end of the appendices that this actually takes place in the past. The whole book takes place in what would be our, like, I think it says 1331 AD. Yeah. So the appendices are, like, this part that are written for humans to read later when humans, I guess, encounter contact. So the story takes place in the past, and humans as we know them really aren't involved. Humans as we know them aren't really involved, and Earth as we know it isn't really involved in this story until you get to the appendix.
I'm sure we don't realize how many noises we make until, like, you hear them all in a recording.
Let it not be said that I didn't advocate for a sound studio.
You are going to be hearing so much about that chair squeaking in this, I'm pretty
what
sure.
Chair? Like,
I can
chair
read the reviews now.
Okay, the sound studio would not stop the chair from squeaking.
I know.
So.
It would just deaden the sound.
How would it deaden the sound?
Because it wouldn't be bouncing off your walls.
If you want to buy a little tent, Tony, go for it.
I might just.
I'm going to go ahead and chew this while we're...
while we're yelling at each other.
I mean, you know you want to keep that.
Hmm.
So you know you want to keep that.
Outtakes, part four.
So as I said, this society is post-scarcity. There's a quote here that I like, that I highlighted, that I think gives you a good idea of what the culture society is like. The culture saw itself as being a self-consciously rational society, and machines, even sentient ones, were more capable of achieving these desired states, as well as more efficient at using it once it had. That was good enough for the culture. Besides, it left the humans in the culture free to take care of things that really mattered in life, such as sports, games, romance, studying dead languages, barbarian societies and impossible problems, and climbing high mountains without the aid of a safety harness.
I almost wondered if that was sarcastic. Like,
I mean, it was sarcastic, but at the same time, it's one of those, like, it's said in jest, but it's kind of true. Because they actually say that in the other book I read, where there's a human doing a task, and the SC agent who's talking to that human is like, why are you doing this? A machine could just do it. And he's like, well, because I want to feel useful.
Isn't that, like, a famous quote that's something like, you know, like, what separates humans from animals? And it's like, they're like, art, or whatever.
So. I'm sure there is.
There's a quote for anything you want to say, basically.
So, since it is this post-scarcity society, my description of the culture was kind of as this ultimate liberal socialist utopia. But is it true to say it's socialist if it is post-scarcity? Because the whole idea of socialism, I would say, without being an economist, is that you're spreading the wealth around to...
But if you don't have to worry about that,
right.
Then...
In this society, there's no limitation on wealth, essentially. So is it really socialist if...
Well, maybe
it doesn't need to be spread around.
That's probably the closest thing we can compare it to in our...
In our own reality,
in our own reality.
Since
like,
we're
people
not
understand socialism, so, like...
It's more like utopian.
Right, like, I called it utopian socialist, but is it even technically socialist?
Whatever.
I feel like, though, if you say socialist, though, people will know what you're talking about.
Right.
So...
I found it in my, like, when I envisioned how he was writing all of this to be, like, for some reason, I envisioned the entirety of the world kind of in sepia tones. Like, I envision everything being very, like, brown and tan and not very colorful in any way.
Interesting. I did not, but I can see.
Because throughout the whole thing, there wasn't very mention of, like, explicit colors.
Hmm.
You know, I also noticed he never meant, like, he very rarely said, like, left and right. And there wasn't, like, a lot of... like, explication of bodies. Because, like, there were so many times where it was like, well, which hand did Horace's finger get, like, eaten off of? Was it his left hand or his right hand? We don't know, because they never told us. Like,
that didn't occur to me.
Yeah.
Very nondescript.
Yeah. But also,
so for a book that has a lot of description, there was also not a lot of description.
In human terms.
It didn't say which hand he pulled free. I thought it did.
A lot of useless
description. I'm pretty
sure
didn't he just, like, I remember, like, noticing, I was like, so, like, does he just, like, not use the words left and right? And then eventually later he did, but I was like, it's weird. He didn't say, like, his left pinky or what did the cute little British term that they use? Like, it wasn't little finger. It was like, anyway.
I always think it's interesting when you have a story. It's like the classic, like, God problem of evil, where, like, if God is perfect, God is all powerful, God is benevolent, then why are there any problems? And you kind of get that with something like the culture. Everything in the culture, because it's manipulated by these minds who are supposed to know almost everything and can process and can predict almost any outcome, everything should be perfect. So you kind of have to create problems in the context of the story. Like, you have to introduce this massive outside force, like the Adirans, to shake things up in the culture. And even like in the story, we're not really in the culture for the story, because the culture is just going to be too perfect. It wouldn't be interesting. Like, we're actually taking place in the fringes, where these are these lesser societies, where these free companies are doing all their dirty work, where the SC agents are doing their dirty work to try to help, quote unquote, these other societies. So I thought that was interesting in the setting, is that you had to kind of create issues outside the culture, because there's not really any plot going on inside the culture itself.
That's true. So I think that leads us pretty well into the discussion of the plot. And I think, like, just from my point of view, like, when you actually look at the scope of the Adiran culture war, what we were experiencing as part of it in this book was very insignificant. And frankly, I don't know what actual impact it had on the war. Like, they never say, like, oh, well, you know, like, Balvita finding that mind was, like, really the decisive whatever. Like, no.
Like, yeah, that's true. It really was kind of inconsequential, wasn't mm-hmm. it, to the ultimate war effort.
But that's life, isn't it? Like,
and it did specifically say that the war was over 40 years long, and wasn't this only 6 years into it?
Something so, like that. It was pretty early.
So
like,
this before, is the majority of the war still hasn't even happened yet.
It was before they started fighting back, because everyone keeps mentioning, like, oh, they're running away.
They're on the retreat, away. Yeah.
But that gives it, like, a hint of realism.
Yeah, because in our wars, like, people do things that matter to them, but ultimately don't matter to the larger cause all the time. Like,
right, and it's really unrealistic in other books, of even in this genre of sci-fi, where it's this one person who, it's all that matters, this person's going to save the entire universe themselves. That's super unrealistic. Like, that never happens.
It's true. There's a lot of, like, hero fiction out there, you know, that we have this template of.
I mean, there's something to be said for both types of stories, mm-hmm. so.
I just wanted to acknowledge, like, I made a note that, like, this story was basically like, oh, so am I reading, like, the side novel to this very successful series? That's almost what it felt like. Like, I was reading a spinoff.
The war was really just trappings and setting. It mm-hmm. wasn't really, like, this wasn't about a battle in the war. And actually, like, to put it in even, like, more context, the war itself was almost insignificant in the end, because he specifically says in the appendices that it was a small, short war that rarely extended throughout more than 0.02% of the galaxy by volume and 0.01% by stellar population. So even in the end of the novel, he's like, this story didn't matter to the war, and then the war didn't matter to the galaxy.
And that's the way it's just kind of the world goes, I suppose.
In general, this was, like, kind of a bleak book, like, I think,
yeah,
because
that's true.
The ending, like, it worked really hard to subvert closure, I thought. Well, because, you know, like,
well, yeah, because I remember getting close to the end of the book, and I'm like, I know this is almost over. Are they going to wrap anything up here? Like, and then they kind of did, kind of didn't.
Right. They did, like, the movie ending, like, where are they now?
Yeah, like,
what happened to them?
The print that appears on screen at the end of the movie. It was, like, with the little pictures of this person. Yeah.
Like, all five
the
characters
Breakfast Club
that were alive at the end.
The Breakfast Club ending.
They did that in It, too.
But, yeah, it was just kind of, like, weird because, you know, you follow this vaguely unsympathetic asshole for, like, 400 pages. And then at the end, like, oh, he dies. And his mission was basically pointless. So.
Welcome to the real world, kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know. I understand what you're saying. Like, I agree. Although, talking about the ending, like, when I was reading it, one of my favorite phrases of all time came into my head, and that's the joke read that everybody makes, rocks fall, everybody dies. That's essentially how this book ended.
I was thinking that when you all were talking about
it. Yeah, it really was. Very, very Hamlet.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the rocks while everyone dies.
Well,
like, oh,
just like everyone dies in the end, almost.
Yeah. Although, I do have to say that I really enjoyed Unaha Clasp's ending. I found it really amusing
Charming.
That there is a retired robot with hobbies. I love the thought of that. I giggled so hard.
I agree. And it was like the quirkiest hobby. Like, he builds animatronic or steam-powered animatrons.
Yeah,
and
I was
right.
like, this
automaton.
Is adorable. And he was my favorite character.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that. Yeah, in characters. But.
So, I maybe just talking about the structure a little bit. Did you guys think it was well laid out? Like, I'll say from my point, like, I was like, wow, this is very much like, it was laid out almost like a TV show. I could see this very easily
really
being adapted.
Yeah.
Because, like, each chapter was like an arc within itself.
Yeah, yeah. Like, each one was, like, a season and, like, seven.
Well, I don't know if each one was a season, but, yeah.
It's sections like the Temple of Light.
Right, like, yeah. I take your point. Yeah. Like, they were in a like different place in each section. And then
and that might have been why, you guys remember I said at the beginning, I found it a little hard to figure out what the plot of the story was, and I think that's probably why, is because we were doing lots of different plots. But then I thought about it, like, some of the books that I read do the same thing. Like, the Percy Jackson series, that's basically what it is going from this adventure to this adventure to this adventure for an ultimate goal. Like,
one thing I thought was interesting, and I'll probably touch on this more in the genre discussion, but it reminded me a lot of the Known Space universe with Larry Niven's stories. Not just because part of it takes place on an orbital, and that's the Ring World, essentially, on a different scale. But he does the same thing. Like, they go to the Ring World, they interact with these people, and then they move somewhere else, and then they interact with these people and move somewhere else.
Yeah,
so it felt very similar to that.
There's a lot of, like, books and TV shows that go like that. So after I figured out that's what was happening, I was like, oh, okay. So now I know what's going on. I got this.
With an ultimate goal in mind the whole time.
With an ultimate goal to find the mind in this one. So, like, okay.
An ultimate goal in mind.
But,
the mind was the ultimate goal in mind, yes.
Put that in.
To get to Char's world.
You should do sound effects, Jared, of the rim shop.
So, did anyone think that there were kind of, like, superfluous parts of the book? There were parts that I thought were superfluous, but I'd be curious to hear what other people thought first.
I was just... So, when he's on that one planet with, like, the really fat leader guy...
Fuisong.
Fuisong, yeah, that guy. I was like... Like, I understand this is, like, a bump in the road to where he needs to go, but first of all, do I need to know this? And second of all, do I need to know all of this? Because this is gross as fuck.
Yeah,
like,
that
happens a lot.
Like, it was so disgusting.
So anyone...
I was on the plane listening to that part. I'm like...
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very repulsive. Did anyone else, like... Okay, maybe this was just me, but when he was, like, crushing that guy, I was like, is he face-fucking you? Like,
oh my god, I was a little bit. I was a little bit. I'm like, he's killing him, right?
He's not, okay.
Because, like, they were saying that he got sweaty or whatever, and I was like,
right.
Oh my. Like,
he was lowered onto the man's body. I'm like, to crush. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, it made sense once he got off, but I was like, I think there's probably some cum on it.
Not sponsored by George Takei.
If somebody look closely.
Like. Please follow us.
Hey, girl, hey, please follow.
We broke into two different conversations there.
But it's important that we build up famous reader listenership.
Oh my god. So I will say, yes, I agree that one totally could have been cut without really subtracting anything from the book.
Superfluous. Basically, the entire prologue with the exception of two sentences. Can we agree on that?
Do you mean by the prologue, do you mean the part where they're like, the mind landed on the planet, or whatever?
Like, that's all you need to know, the mind landed on the planet. We don't need to know.
They tell you that later, in fact.
Right, but we don't need to know every single individual part of a warship. Like, we could rebuild our own. Like, it goes through, and they're just probably like, oh, this piece, and this piece, and this piece, and it goes on for two paragraphs.
The whole beginning was kind of vague and confusing to me. Like, so the mind was confusing, and then when you get to the next part, like, one of my pet peeves with books is books that try to be clever by starting out with, like, vague openings using just pronouns instead of
I've totally done that in my own writing.
Sorry, Tony.
I'll remember not to try to get you to read the book that I did.
I think there are people that like that and people that don't.
I'm sure there are people that like that. I am not one of those people. It drives me bananas. I'm like, you're going to introduce me to this character, so just fucking do it. Like,
oh, no, see, at least in my own defense, when I did it, it was a character, I didn't name him because he was inconsequential to the story.
Oh, okay.
It was literally just someone to see the inciting incident.
Okay. Continuing off of that, though, I am really glad that the book did evolve and didn't stay at the same type of pace that the prologue set. It did get better.
Agreed.
But
so, superfluous, I was annoyed that we only got three scenes with Fal and Jace.
Yeah. Because
first off,
I liked them. I did,
oh,
too.
I wanted to know more about them. I wanted them to be more involved, because she didn't even seem to make any decisions that were consequential to Horza. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because
as I was getting close to the end of the book, I was like,
what's this bitch doing?
What's she doing? I like her. What's she up to? Like?
They're like, her involvement in the story was of no consequence, and here's what happened to her. She never met the character she wanted to meet.
Sometimes, like, throughout the course of the book, I was wondering, unless they factor in later books, why were they introduced at all in this series?
Right. I mean, maybe they were part of the larger universe. in the other novel, they don't mention the referrers, so they're not in that one.
But they might be in...
But they might be in other others. Ones, yeah.
I was thinking that might be where they are.
Or some of the short stories.
My thinking was that they were there to kind of give more context for the culture side of things. Because really, we mostly just hear about the Edirian side of things, and Horse is like harumphy about them.
That's true. I guess, yeah. Yeah, like, you get more of. I guess, like I said, most of it doesn't take place inside the culture, but they are inside the culture. So I guess that's your glimpse inside that actual world.
And then I think the other thing is, like, she really expands a little bit more on the theme of identity of the book. Which we can talk about later, but...
I mean, like I was saying, my pet peeve wasn't that they were superfluous, it was that I wanted, more of them.
Yeah. I agree.
Than we
got. They were so interesting, like, I was like, why do we not know more about these people? Yeah, yeah,
like,
pretty
much. Like, if her and Jace had been on this adventure, with Jace being, like, kind of...
Him and Unaha Klaus, like yeah. going back and forth with each other would have been amazing.
That would have been
Do not disrespect Miss Fowl, or whatever, like...
Yes.
The sections, I thought there, in addition to the cannibal one, I thought there were two kind of pointless sections, and also kind of the foul stuff. I thought that, just for streamlining, he probably could have cut out the Temple of Light, because I didn't think it was that engaging, frankly, and, like...
It just because he needed to kill off those characters?
Yeah, but, like, don't introduce those characters. Like, so, like, really all you get from that is that, like, Horsey became a little more integrated to the crew. Lesbian, like,
I'll
barrier
talk about
gaze.
That in my lesbian subtext, yep.
and the people who survive were traumatized. Like, I feel like... I don't know. We didn't.
But it could have been a shorter.
Yeah, it didn't need
to get to that conclusion.
And like,
I think
also,
it was supposed to be like it was the captain's all like his first of many failures.
Well, but like then the megaship, he fails on that too. So like the incompetence point could have also been without doing. I don't know. That's just my argument. And then finally,
when we get to characters, we will talk about how grossly incompetent that man is, and also
and
just gross in general. Yeah.
So the final chapter I thought was kind of pointless was the damage chapter. I really liked it.
Oh, yeah. Like, I really enjoyed reading that. Like, one of my notes was like, damage. Weird, but very interesting.
Yeah.
Like, the whole thing. I was like, this is a lot of fun. Can we do, like, a side novel just about damage games? Like, I would read that.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to talk about the characters in that, too. But, yeah, like, in terms of the overall plot, like, he could have found Craiglin anywhere. And
is that
the plot
how you pronounce his name? Just FYI.
Craiglin, yeah.
Craiglin.
Yeah, he could have found Craiglin anywhere, and the plot would have continued, you know?
That's
he could have
true.
Killed them. So I was like, in terms of actual narrative structure, it wasn't...
Side note, I listened to the audiobook. They read the Kindle version, so... They might ask me how things are pronounced here and there.
We pronounce the name our way.
And I might ask them how they're spelled.
Oh, that's true.
There were parts where I was, like, reading along with the Kindle while I was listening to it, so I've seen most of the words, but...
And let me know if I'm going on too long here, but in, like, speaking of the damage section, once we... Dara, did you, like, eye roll or something?
No, I was laughing because you said, let me know if I'm going on too long, but you seemed to be, you were looking at the mic like you were asking the mic for permission to continue.
I mean, you guys get interrupted.
I just kind of shrugged my shoulders because I was like, you know what? If it goes on too long, I'll just edit you out.
Oh, thanks. So, I was going to say that by the time the damage game happened, I was like, okay, are we going to get to Char's world? Like,
yeah,
I'm ready for this.
Yeah, agreed. Definitely agreed, yeah.
So there was a little bit too much, and that's why I think cutting out some of that other stuff would have really helped the book feel a little tighter. And also, I just want to say, I feel like he could have pivoted, you know? Like, oh, like, this clear air turbulence thing isn't really working that great. Like, let me think up another plan. Because... I don't know. He seemed really fixated on that when he was in this giant port city, and I feel like he could have come up with an alternative instead of whatever.
That's true. He could have, like, found other transport to Char's world. So maybe the one thing that might have gotten him back to the clear air turbulence was Yelsin.
I think that's probably why that was his motivation for
But he was such an emotionally stunted dick that didn't really
I mean, the whole time he was kind of resisting the idea that he might actually care about Yelsin. Yeah. But it could have still been an undercurrent.
I did have one more point. Sorry. No, I really wanted to talk about this. I liked, so the final chapters I thought were actually really well done in terms of, like, the dominoes that he set up. Because, you know, like, the last, what, four chapters all take place on Char's world and in the command system. So I was like, okay, like, there was obviously a little bit of contrivance that had to happen. Like, oh, so convenient that helmet was covering the alarm light or whatever. I literally, like, almost put down the book. not put down the book, but I was like,
It was an eye roll.
Yeah, it was.
Device.
Yeah, so there was a little bit of that. But, like, overall, a lot of it made sense, and I thought was, like, set up really well to kind of That's get true. That plot.
The only thing I didn't really like about it was the jumping from character POV to character POV, but we'll get into that later. So moving on to characters. At first, I found it really hard to, like, connect with any of these characters. Like, normally when I'm reading a book, I can automatically, within, like, the first few chapters, be like, oh, I really like this person, or this person is a total douche. Like, I have strong opinions about characters pretty much from the get-go, and I just did not. I did not care about most of the characters in this book. Until, like, I'd say my favorite is definitely Unaha Clasp. Like, although... Seconded. Yeah.
Do we all agree on that?
Yeah. I think we all agree on that. And I know... Okay, so for context, the listeners, we keep saying he, but technically Unaha Clasp does not have a gender. Like, the pronoun drone. That's you, the drone, and, like, the pronoun that uses it most of the time. So, like, you know, because of the patriarchy, we use he as the go-to. But, yeah. Anyway.
Side note, Erin is wearing a Smash the Demon Lizard patriarchy shirt.
But found the Vampire Slayer. Listen to it. Such a good podcast. Anyway, now that I've promoted them, please listen to us.
Like, follow, subscribe.
Okay, yeah. Loved Unaha Clasp. Its sassiness was
a breath of fresh air.
Love it. Like, love it. Like, as soon as it started talking, I was like, oh my god, I'm actually enjoying words that are coming out of things' mouths in this story. I really, really liked. Although, I will say, at the end of the book, like, when he gets damaged and starts talking in nonsense, I laughed the whole time. Not because I was like, I thought it was funny, but because it was like, ba la 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 la, which reminded me of Big Hero 6 the whole time. Like, so every time, like, he was saying that nonsense string of letter, the B&A in LA, all I could hear in my head was, Baymax, ba la la. Like, that's what I heard the whole time, but...
Of course, we already mentioned his, like, adorable, one of the two characters that survived everything.
Yeah.
Well, actually, three if you count the mine.
Right, that's true.
He ended up making steam-powered automatons.
Yeah, so really, really liked him. My least favorite character was definitely Craiglin. He was a super gross misogynist, and every time he did anything, I wanted to, like, reach through the book and punch him in the face. It was
it's true.
A disaster. And even, like, Horza, the main character.
Yeah, he was a white version of Craiglin.
Yeah, he was quite a bit of a dick.
We get away from Craiglin for a while, so I, like, forgot how awful he was.
Right.
So when you get to the part where, like, Horace is about diary. To kill him. I'm like, Horace is actually going to kill a man in cold blood. And I'm like, oh, wait, that's right. This guy's terrible. Kill him, Horace!
He didn't do anything to Horace, really. I mean, besides make him fight in that duel to the death.
Right, like he did.
Except for that.
I mean, our first introduction to Craiglin is holding a gun to the guy's head. That's...
So a lot of the characters in here, as you mentioned, are hard to pronounce. And I find, like, when I can't pronounce a character's name, my eyes kind of glaze over them. And if my eyes kind of glaze over them, I don't connect with them. So I think the biggest, example of that is, okay, how the fuck do you say that guy's name, Tony?
Jandra Lajeri.
Okay, it is spelled, listeners, by the way, J-A-N-D-R-A-L-I-G-E-R-I. L-I. Seriously, did Ian M. Banks just plop his cat onto the keyboard and let him walk across to create some of these names? Because that was nonsense. Sorry, rant over.
I mean, there were definitely, like, Unaha Clasp, I made a note when he bopped up. I was like, I like this drone a lot, but, like, did they have to give him the most obnoxious name in the book after blah, blah, blah?
Just fill in your own name.
Honestly, when he was arguing for his name, when he was like, I have a name, and it's this, I'm like, can he just call you Drone?
Yeah, because that's way better. And, like, another part that my eyes kind of glazed over was the introduction of the original company members. Because it was basically just a list of people. And I'm just like, I don't really care. And then it turns out that was fine because half of them die in the first Temple of Light battle. And then the rest die at the end of the... So it doesn't... Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I was not keep... I mean...
Okay. So I'm not alone in that.
It probably would have been better if I was actually looking at the words, but listening to the audiobook, I definitely glazed over a lot of those secondary characters.
The secondary
like,
character?
This character was just killed the Adirin. And I'm like, who was he again?
So I will say that, like, all of us read the book at sort of different paces. So I was blessed and that Erin, like, started the book and got to that point before me. So we did a little discussion about it. And she was like, so just so you know, when they introduce a million characters, most of them are going to die. So just kind of skim that section. So I did. And it was very helpful.
You are welcome.
Although at the end, I was like, what was Avenger's, like, quirk? Like, because, you know, the people that survived, I was like, I don't really
nice
know
thing
anything
about reading
them.
It on Kindle is you can do a search for that name. So yeah, you can go back to the beginning. That's what I do with a lot of other Kindle books when I'm reading it. I'm like, oh. This character was important in the beginning, but I don't remember who they were. They were like a secondary or tertiary character.
Oh, that's good.
Well, maybe
to know.
On yours. My Kindle's old as fuck. I can't do that.
I can do that on the Paperwhite.
I can probably do that. I didn't know you could.
So it's great that you can like go back and you're like, oh, that's why they were important.
I can do it on the Kindle app. I can't do it on my actual
right.
Kindle, yeah.
But yeah, so I still don't know what Avenger's deal was, besides that he was kind of a grumpy old man. But...
I mean, that's basically all you needed to know about him. Like,
Podgy Dodger.
Yeah. yeah, that's basically all
so
my
I
notes
think,
about characters.
I guess we should talk about our, like, the other three principal characters, who are, what, Yelsin, Horza, yeah. and Belveda?
Yeah.
Like,
right. No, okay, so that's not true. I did actually really enjoy Belveda. Like, I thought she was... Because you never knew where she stood at
yeah,
any point in time,
kind of
so she was... Yeah, I really like... And I'll talk about her a little bit more in my lesbian subtext section as well, so...
Yeah, I liked her element of mystery.
I definitely got, like, in the beginning... She seems, like, important, and then she gets killed,
oh,
and
yeah.
I'm like, this
I
is definitely a Marvel,
this
is a Marvel Cinematic Universe death. You are definitely coming back.
Yeah.
But, like, the whole time, like, she's kind of, like, set up because she's part of the culture, and Horza is working for the Adirans. Like, she's kind of set up as, like, an antagonist, but she's not really.
Yeah,
like,
it's hard to root against
and you
her.
Find yourself, like, I don't know about the rest of you, but I found myself connecting with the culture a lot more than I connected with the idea, and so maybe that's why she was such a favorite for me, was because I kind of understood her a little bit
right
better than some of the other ones, but yeah.
I will say that I liked that she came back, and I liked her as a character, but it was like, what did she really add to the book besides a little bit of a counterpoint?
Because
she literally was, like, restrained for half of her entire existence.
But, like, she was, like, planning things, like, five moves ahead. You could tell, so...
Like, they mentioned that one part where she's lying down in the dark room, and she, like, feels her back tooth, and I'm like, what's in that soup? Like, is it arsenic or something?
She's being very GLaDOS.
That's the thing from Portal, right?
Yeah. The whole,
like,
bound
so,
up, thinking way ahead.
Yeah, so I agree that she probably
the
didn't
reference.
Add a whole lot,
yeah.
but she added it for me,
yes,
personally.
Yes,
I enjoyed her.
I just mean in terms of actual...
Oh, yeah, no,
yeah.
I totally agree. I'm just
she
saying,
was,
like, personally, I...
Yeah, I agree.
She was definitely, like, the representative of the culture in the plot.
Yeah.
And which, I guess, was important. This being his first book in the series seems so strange to me because, at least the other one I read, is definitely from the point of view of someone directly working for... the culture, and I assume this would be too. So I was thinking we were going to get, like, her perspective more, but then we're following Horza, and he's actually working against the culture because he's working for the Adirans, which was really weird because the culture is kind of set up as this ideal society that I feel like in the whole series he admits has problems, but you're still supposed to root for it. So I did think it was interesting that we're getting the other perspective in his first book.
Yeah. But maybe you would have thought differently if you'd read the first book first.
Maybe.
Like, sometimes, like, in your mind, whatever you read first is first.
And I also thought it was interesting that the culture seems so fleshed out already. Because I feel like a lot of authors will, like, build up the mythos of the story as they go in the series. But he already knew what the culture was, what its
like
pros
he had this
and its cons
pretty
were.
Planned out before he even started it, yeah.
Yeah,
it's a feat.
He definitely lived in this universe for a while, I feel like, before he wrote the first one.
So, I guess let's talk about Yelsin, and then we can finish with the main character.
Yelsin kind of was just the love interest. Like, she had, like, her moments where she was, like, one of the few people that would actually, like, argue against him and Craiglin on things.
Right.
So, like, a couple times I was like, yeah, you fucking tell him, Yelsin.
Yeah.
Like, I did enjoy that. I did not like how her story ended.
No. Yes.
In
and
any way,
I think
shape,
we can
or
talk
form.
About that in our little feminist.
In our feminism section, we'll talk about that a little bit more, but I want to put it out there,
yeah.
I did not enjoy the ending of her
I
story.
I did not expect her to be as important as she was from the
Agreed.
Beginning.
That's
because
awesome.
he started off
just
saying,
sleep with her and then
yeah.
be done.
Right.
Like,
right off the bat, he's like, we'll never be more than friends.
Yeah, I actually made a note.
And I believed him in that regard. Like, usually I'd be like, oh, you two are gonna go at it hard.
I actually, like, put that in when I was making my notes about lesbian subtext. I was like, oh, so maybe he's, like, feeling something for her. Like, he's like, oh, we're never gonna be more than friends because she is. Mm-hmm. And then I was, but I did put probably gonna sleep with her anyway. And then later when he did, I went back up and wrote, booyah, I was right.
Well, yeah, I liked her for the most part, although there was a moment where, like, I was like, who is this character? And
yeah.
She was a bit, well, it was more like I couldn't get a read on her because she was serving a lot of functions in the plot. Like, she was basically the second in command.
Right.
But she was also the love interest. Right. And she was also, like, one thing that, like, bothered me was when Horace was like, oh, well, y'all would be so mad if I killed Alvita. And I'm like, why? Why would she care? Like, literally, she got on, when you got on the ship and it was revealed that you would kill Craig, when she was like, shrug. Like,
she really was, so, yeah. She's a mercenary.
Who cares?
So, yeah.
Maybe it's just because she didn't like Craiglin, but he thought she liked, because he said something about, like, they see, like, Alvita was getting a rapport with the rest of the crew members, and that all of them would be irritated if he killed her. And I was like, but would they?
But, like, really early on, he's like, like, when she first joins the ship, he's like, oh, I don't think Yelsman would like it if I killed her. And I was like, why? Why would she care? She's a mercenary.
And she's known this chick for, like, an hour.
And you told her she's, like, an enemy agent.
Yeah.
It struck me as plot convenience.
You had some, like, good reasonings for it that I'm sure if you had told her, she would have been like, oh, okay. Yeah.
And then so now I guess we can talk about Horza.
Horse is an asshole. Like, I don't think I've ever read a book where I dislike the main character quite as much as in this book.
Like, it was interesting.
Which I think
the whole time I was like, this is going to make for an interesting discussion when we just ask the question, how did you feel about Horace?
Which I think that's a bold move to make your protagonist such an unlikable person.
I agree, yeah.
Horace actually reminds me a lot of some of the characters in his position in other science fiction stories, like in the Larry Niven's novels. There are characters that are like, I'm doing the practical thing even if it's kind of amoral, and some people
logical
might die
emotion, yeah.
as a consequence, but it has to be done because he's working for what he thinks is a greater good.
Mm-hmm. Ah yes, collateral damage.
Right, he doesn't really stop to think about the collateral damage.
And there's even other characters like that. Care.
In, like, the Known Space Universe in Alistair Reynolds' books, there's a lot of that. Like, I'm joining in with these pirates or these mercenaries, and they're really amoral, and there's a lot of collateral damage, but I have an end goal to get to.
That's actually quite like the Admiral in Ender's Game.
Yes.
Where Ender kind of just went with it, and the Admiral's like, oh, all those people? Yeah, fuck them. We're going to win.
There also might be potential spoilers for other books and TV series. He's just...
I'm just saying, in general, there are a lot of characters like this in science fiction, where they have practical concerns that they're and goals they're trying to get to, and there's going to be a lot of collateral damage.
No, I understand what you're saying. I just thought I would put that out there as we get into discussions about other...
Mm.
Culture things, we'll try our best not to spoil things other than this book.
I actually have a really interesting question about Horza that I wanted to get your all's opinions on. So knowing, giving a little extra backstory on this, that we mentioned earlier that Horza is a changer, that he changes himself to fit into different societies, different situations and stuff. But does Horza as himself really exist anymore? Can you go through that many changes through your existence and still hold to yourself?
We have a whole section about identity. I thought we were going to get into
it. I think that's, like, the central question the book is asking in some ways.
Yeah,
like,
I agree.
So do we want to get more into it when we get to the identity section?
More into
that
later.
You can just move that section.
Because that question is definitely, like, you're beat over the head with it when you get to his, like, dying words.
I didn't really, like, pick up on that identity was such a key part of the book until, like, the millionth, like, introspection section. And then it was, like, it was the damage game, I think, where he's like, who am I? And I was like, oh, okay. So clearly they're leaning pretty hard on this identity theme.
Right. But so, yeah, we'll get into that when we talk identity.
So.
Any more on character?
I mean, do we want to specify, like, who Horza is, where he comes from, and what he's doing? Because... So, like, Horza is a changer, which is a species that comes from this asteroid. They're humans Humanoid. Humanesque. I like that. Humanesque.
I just called them shapeshifters in the synopsis.
Yeah, like their thing is that they've had so much genetic engineering done to them that they can actually manipulate their own image. And so they get hired by other races to impersonate. They get hired specifically by the Adirans to impersonate these other beings. Like he starts out on the one world with the
Sorpin,
yeah.
Also, the gerontocracy of
Sorpin.
What is?
The whole shapeshifter thing. They have the shifter race.
Yeah. There's actually a line where they suggest that other races hire them too, because like in backstory where he's like, I killed those rabble rousers, which I did not agree with. Like, who was he to kill those people? Was he a government agent that whole time? Anyway.
Yeah, they do kind of gloss over that.
Yeah.
But the changers like are kind of scattered, it sounds like, and few in number these days.
Well, they said in that section that the Academy, or whatever the ruling body of the changer asteroid was happy with him killing those people because there wasn't an uproar. They stayed where they were, and the changers were employed more than ever, or something like that.
Yeah, but they still had to punish him, so they had to exile him.
So I took it to mean that they were basically like the spy race of the
yeah, race. That's definitely the role that they serve, is they get hired by these other species, like the Adirans. And like now that's like part of the plot, is that he's changing throughout the story to impersonate the captain, Craiglin. And I thought it was kind of funny, like, when he finally does get the chance to be Craiglin, he's Craiglin for all of 5 minutes before Balmaine exposes him.
Yeah.
That was a lot of lead up and like he like
that was a lot of lead up for not a lot of follow through.
I mean, it was amusing to me because he took all that time to learn how to sound like Craiglin, to get into Craiglin's basic shape so that he could, in like one changer trance, change his face into Craiglin and become Craiglin convincingly enough that Yelsin actually even believed it. And like after all that workup, when he finally becomes Craiglin, he's Craiglin for 5 minutes, and Belveda comes in and she's like, "Yeah, that is Horza."
Y'all are idiots.
So, two more notes I wanted to make about character. I want a Sarvan the Eye spinoff, like the million spinoff I want of this book. Like, I'm so curious about like her deal. And did anyone else like her?
Oh, I love like the beginning like spiel she goes on about the damage game. I'm like, I was laughing actually through that part. I'm like, it was after a lull. I was glad to get to that for some comic relief.
Consider Fleavis, the book we're looking more into getting a spinoff than continuing the actual series.
Oh my god, it's true. And then I really just want a spinoff of the Damage People, because I took notes on all of them, and they're uniformly ridiculous. So I don't know if anybody else remembers these, but let me just read some of the descriptions. There was the guy who replaced his face with a mask, not because he had any damage to his face, because he wanted to be a better card shark. There was the guy who throws money at people because he has too much. Also has fancy pheromone-enhanced concubines that give people hard-ons. And a weird creature that he pulls around on a chain with emeralds for eyes. He took out the eyes, by the way. It's not a creature with actual emeralds for eyes. And then there's the warrior woman with no breasts, who Craiglin doesn't like because he's an asshole. I was all about Xena, titless Xena over here.
That's staying in.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was the quote-unquote diseased, half-blind, incontinent, and albino kid who carries around a stuffed animal. And to me, he sounds like a dystopic version of an anime trope. Like, the hyper-competent, like, kid who carries around a stuffed animal and is really good at, like, Yu-Gi-Oh! Or whatever. Like,
that's
probably true.
Or, like, Sabrina with the doll. Pokemon.
So, okay. That's my spiel. Oh, and another damage anecdote. So I will say that my, like, all-time saddest characters in the book, I thought, were those little clawed beasts that were, like, clawing each other over the damage arena.
Oh, yeah.
They just kept giving us an update on for some reason.
I know. Right. I was like, stop it.
They were this much bloodier, and then this much bloodier, and now they're dead.
And it sounded like they were kind of dancing, or it was like a romance, and then it turned dark. And I was like, no. And nobody was even watching. Why did they do this?
I agree.
And this is the culture, too. Like, this is Vavatch. It's supposed to be part of the culture at this point.
I mean, not necessarily because it's the damage game, which is illegal.
Oh, that's right.
Culture,
that's true. It was said it was banned.
It still felt like bullshit. Like, no one's even watching them kill themselves. Like, I made a really sad face when I did that. Anyway, so next section. Ugh.
Yes, go ahead, Aaron. Regale us about your mushroom.
Okay, right. So I forgot to tell them not to put mushrooms in my stir-fried vegetable at the Thai restaurant last night, which I realize is my own fault, but I still call bullshit. Because they weren't just, like, those little, like, pieces, like, round pieces of mushroom. They were, like, the legit phallic-shaped mushrooms just, like, thrown all into my shit. I was not happy.
Even hearing that twice, the phallic shape was still really funny. I don't know why.
No, you did not see these mushrooms, Adam. They were legit. Jared will tell you.
Stalk and head everything.
Yeah, they were full phallic symbolism. Which was not going anywhere near my mouth.
And meanwhile, me and Meredith were eating them off of her plate.
Yeah, but you guys like those things, so...
I might have excused myself to the bathroom. Pie's in there. I mean, maybe, because then you can just throw in jokes in, like, really dry parts. Out of context. And people probably be like, what?
Actually, I had already planned on doing that without anybody's knowledge.
Kentoven.
Hot. No one said we were fancy drunk bitches.
We are cheap.
We have a martini glass on our image.
Fine. I will make myself uncomfortable for the...
I pointed it in your direction so that you didn't have to do that, but then I got questioned about it.
Adam and I are loving this.
Okay, shipping.
So shipping. So for those who are not familiar, shipping is a fan term to indicate when you are rooting for, like, a pair plus of characters to get together. And frequently it's, like, non-canon pairings, but it can also be canon pairings.
So, who is there anybody you all ship?
I don't know if this was obvious or not, but Fal and Malveda.
I will be talking about it in my lesbian stuff section, yes.
Can I say okay. Why? Because, okay, yeah. Just, I mean, not, I won't, a little obvious.
I don't have a lot of in-depth about it, but I do mention it.
Okay, so Fal and Malveda. Fal, of course, is the referrer who is on the other side of the galaxy from where the action's happening with her drone caretaker. She's the, like, super smart woman who can figure things out that sometimes the minds can't. So they watch her carefully and basically employ her to figure things out. That's who Fal is, and she mentions a few times that she thinks Malveda is exciting.
And wants to meet her.
Yeah, she's the SC agent on the other side of the galaxy who's so cool.
I was really sad when she didn't get to.
I know, they specifically gut punch you with that at the end. Yeah. Like, she never met her.
And I was like, but they could have had such a beautiful relationship.
But, and then, like, my heart cracked a little bit when you hear, like, the rest of Fal's story, because Fal eventually becomes an SC agent. So I'm like, oh, she took inspiration from Malveda.
She also did about a million other things. I was like, I want to read her life.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, that was mine, was Fal and Malveda.
No, I agree.
She changed 100%. Gender several times.
She changed gender several times, which I bring out, yeah. Like I said, I didn't really, like, engage too much with these characters, so I didn't really care who they ended up with.
I mean, I definitely wasn't, like, that into Horza and Yalsin. It was just kind of a thing
mostly
that happened.
Mostly because Yalsin could do way better than
she
him.
Could, and it was just kind of like a shrug. I guess he needed to get his dick wet at some point in the book. Like, but as kind of
which
like
which is also a weird trope. I was like, why can't he just, like, not have... Why sex, can't a character just not have a... But whatever.
So I will say that two kind of, like, joke pairings that I thought of were Wubslin and the train, because...
Yes!
That
was definitely the book's real OTP.
Agreed.
And
he stayed behind for that train.
He did.
He died for that train.
And it was all for nothing.
Oh, God. I'm glad you guys got such a kick out of that.
In the grand scheme of the
universe. Is anyone else, like, now seeing the train going into tunnels?
Oh, my God. Like, oh, yeah. You
penetrate that image in my head now. Thank you, Adam.
Yeah, leave it to Adam to give the penetration in people's heads.
A little bit of Skitty on Whale Lord action going on there.
Yeah,
I was really hoping we would find a way to use that trope in this podcast. Thank you, Adam, for that.
And there we are.
So the other pairing, and this would just be kind of like a kind of crack fic, like, or like a non-consensual kind of fic type of deal, would be Avager and Zozarl, or however you pronounce that Adiran's name, who, like, took him hostage and then crushed his skull. But took him hostage and could have, like, raped him in the...
Okay, if we could not do non-consent and rape, that would probably...
Look, the non-consent part, but I get his point, because he's sitting there listening to all his stories. All of the Adiran stories.
Yes.
I just, non-consent and rape are kind of
Forza and the Nimbus 2000.
I'm just saying, I would read a kind
of... So I was thinking, when you mentioned the train, I'm like, Snape and the Nimbus 2000.
Forza and the Nimbus 2000.
The best Harry Potter pairing of all time. Other than James and the Giant Squid.
I was going to say Forza and the Giant Squid. Let's throw that in there, too. Giant space squid.
Right.
I didn't have one. No. Okay. I didn't give a shit about these characters.
Yeah, no, Jared and I were on the same wavelength.
Like, I'm going to be blatantly honest about this.
I mean, like...
very much enjoyed those.
One that I guess is kind of canon is that they mention Jason Fow.
Yeah, I was into that.
Like, he specifically says that Jace is recording Fow's laugh.
Yeah, like, he's clearly in love with her. Yeah.
A little stalkery, but...
I actually wrote that, like, this could be a question. Is this stalkerish or is it aw? Is it adorable?
Yes. That is, like...
Because it's a robot, it was cute, yeah, I think.
I think that's the million-dollar question in a lot of things, because...
Right.
Referring back to Harry Potter, there's a couple moments in there that I'm like, oh, that's really sweet. In a stalkerish kind of way, but still sweet.
Lesbian subtext.
Lesbian subtext.
Okay, speaking of shipping.
All right, speaking of shipping and lesbian subtext.
Aaron's lesbian subtext corner.
Can you add like a cat meowing or like a purring sound effect?
Yes!
Because that would be amazing if it was like Aaron's lesbian subtext corner.
Agreed, agreed.
Here, kitty, kitty.
Okay, so I really thought I was going to have to reach to find any sort of lesbian subtext, but was pleasantly surprised to find out that wasn't the case. At first, I was just kind of noting that some of the female characters were being described in masculine terms, because as we all know, straight women are never masculine. But then I came across actual lesbian subtext in the characters of Gao and Ki Alsorifis. The quote from the book is, Gao and Ki Alsorifis were the two women who kept themselves so much to themselves and were alleged to do things, quote unquote, when alone in the cabin, which seemed to annoy the less tolerant of the company males. That is, most of them. So the way their relationship was described got me thinking about whether these two women were actually together or if the company males just assumed that two women who prefer to spend their time with each other and not with, quote, less tolerant, unquote, men were automatically lesbians. When Ki Alsorifis was killed in the Temple of Light, spoiler alert, Gao was so distraught she ended up killing herself. Right, that isn't necessarily concrete proof that they were romantically linked, as you can be distraught at the death of anybody you have a close relationship with, but I think they probably were. The death of these two probably queer characters brings to mind the barrier gaze trope, sometimes referred to as dead lesbian syndrome, that's come to the forefront of cultural conversation lately, especially in LGBT communities. However, Gao and Ki Alsorifis are not the only characters that die during the course of this book. Actually, basically everyone dies in this book. Trope name, kill them all. So does this anybody-can-die style of storytelling make the death of two queer characters okay, or is it just a way to get around the discussion of positive queer representation?
I will say that this book was written in what year did you say, Jared? 1981?
82.
Mm. So, yes, probably a way to avoid talking about queer characters, but
I feel like he mentioned them to be edgy and then swept them under the rug as soon as possible.
Thanks for name-dropping us, E&M Banks.
So, I guess my question was like not just for this novel, but just like in general when people use this kind of was like, well, yeah, the queer characters died, but so do everybody else. Does that make it okay? Or are they just using it as...
I mean, they definitely died early in the plot so that they didn't become inconvenient.
Yeah,
I will say that particular instance is problematic. Or were you talking about the trope in general?
Both. Anything.
I mean, I guess my defense of it is that when you actually sit down and do the logistics, like, usually one character in a given queer couple is more popular than the other, and, like, so you kill off that less popular character to give the more popular character new love interests, new storylines, because people in happy relationships are boring, and people don't like it when their queer couples are fighting. So they just kill one of them off. Not defending it, just saying from
that's
a narrative...
rationalization
standpoint, I see why they do it sometimes.
Yeah, so I just thought it was interesting in here. Like, I didn't think about it until I was actually making my notes. Like, when I read that they, you know, were allegedly do things, I just automatically assumed. But then I was like, well, maybe they're not. But these men just think because they don't want to spend time with them, they've got to be gay, which is actually an attitude that people have in real life. Mm-hmm, like, if a woman doesn't like, spend her entire life chasing after men, she must be a lesbian. Like, anyway, moving on from that. So, there's also some less explicit lesbian subtext in the character of Valveda. She's described as handsome and with short black hair, which, you know, incidentally, guys, I also have short black hair, so, you know.
It's a lesbian trait.
So it's a, yeah, it's kind of a lesbian thing. All right, anyway, she doesn't have a romantic relationship with anyone, so it's entirely possible she could be queer. She even uses the word gay to describe herself at one point in the book. The quote is, she's talking, she says, 20 years at my mother's side, more than I care to think of, as a gay and dashing young blade, indulging in all the pleasures of the culture has ever produced. So my question is, do you think she meant gay as in homosexual, which is the way we refer to it today, or gay as in happy, which is the kind of historical definition, and if this is taking place in our time of, like, the 1300s?
That's actually really interesting, because, like, I feel like the book was trying to set, like, really set up this kind of vague romance between her and Horza, or this star-crossed lover thing. And wasn't really working for me, so that actually makes a little more sense that she, like, respects him, but she's, like, he's hearing her described as handsome and dashing. Yeah. Like, and
It might be an interesting point to note. I feel like if Ian M. Banks was writing this today, he would absolutely include gay characters in legit marriages and fully out and talking about it. But since it was written in the 80s, I feel like he had to be subtle. He felt like he had to be subtle anyway.
Right.
I feel like it could be a hint to that. I definitely do agree there was like a star-crossed lovers thing going on between, because they're very much like,
I was thinking
we don't
too.
Want to kill each other, but we're on different sides of the war.
That's essentially what I was thinking too, but there were like these little bits and pieces about the way she was described and the way she talked about herself that I was like, I mean, okay, so we're also getting into the thing. Like, she could be into him, but still also be queer. Like, that is that is still 100% a thing that can happen.
Hearing,
like,
hearing her say she participated in all the
pleasures, culture,
that suggests, like, pansexual to me.
Oh, yeah, and think about how easy it is to do things like change your sex in the culture, because it mentions that Fal does it on multiple occasions.
Yeah, actually, that's my next think, note.
Oh, sorry, you can cut that if you don't want to.
I will, I do kind of wonder if, like, when was the last book in the series that he wrote? Like, if he gets more explicit about, like, same-sex relationships in later books. Because, like, he mentions, I think, like, I think there's a line in there about single-sex-oriented people or whatever, like, implying that, like, a lot of, a not insignificant number of people are bisexual or pansexual or what have you. Omnisexual.
Yeah, I'm just using, like, queer as kind of a blanket
term. Queer. It is an art title.
I just, like I said, where the culture seems to be this, like, ultimate liberal, free society.
Free love, whatever,
So I feel like,
damn hippies.
If he was writing it today, he absolutely would have just straight up said, there are queers all throughout.
Yeah. There would be queers society. all over this bitch.
every spectrum is fully explored.
Yeah.
But he had to be subtle because the society was less liberal than he was writing it for.
All right. So the last character that I wanted to very briefly mention was Fal. So she doesn't have as many overt descriptions as some of the other characters, but she seems to be quite good at processing, which I don't know if that's a lesbian thing or if that's a culture thing. And she seems to have an interest in Valveda, which we, you know, we're talking about during the shipping section. So in the epilogue, it's noted that she changes her sex multiple times, so it's entirely possible she's also queer. Does anybody else have any thoughts on...
That actually kind of opens up an interesting question. Was she changing her sex just kind of to try something new? Or was it because she was already gender non-binary? Or, like, was she already feeling that? Or did she just want to try something different? And maybe did she change her identity to match the gender when she changed physically? Because I imagine in something like the culture, you might be able to tweak the neurons to change the identity along with the body. Maybe she was a cis woman as she chose to become a cis man, or was she gender non-binary and she just went back and forth body-wise?
And there's also, it's not entirely clear on whether this is something she can do specifically, or if it's something people in human-esque characters in general can do. Like, can everybody do it, or is it just
I'm pretty sure they can't. I assume it's like a geno-fixing thing.
I assumed it was like a medical procedure that's just easily available in the culture.
Well, like, it seems like they can do a lot with the geno-fixing, because, like, at one point that we will discuss soon.
Yeah.
When Yelsin is talking
When Yelsin
is talking about her pregnancy, she's like, oh, you know, I can just, like, abort it or, like, stop it from growing altogether. It's like,
with my mind. So which it's like, is, in my notes.
So I feel like you could grow a penis, or, you know, you could grow a vagina, true, you could, or grow whatever you want. Biology.
Yeah. Oh, to answer your earlier question, at least going by Goodreads, the latest book in the series that I see is The Hydrogen Sonata. It's the 10th book in the series, and it came out in 2012.
So yeah, it probably has some games.
Oh, that sucks. That means he probably still had other books.
Yeah, he had one gestating. Well, did you guys
He died in 2013, listeners, in case you're wondering why we're... Yeah.
So, total diversion, but I was really sad that the... I can't remember her name. The chick that writes the Alphabet series, you know? Like, A is for...
Oh.
Yeah.
Her.
It's like a... It's a thriller mystery series, and she got to Y, and she was working on Z, and then she died. This past year.
Oh my god, that's awful.
Her name was like Sue
Grafton,
something. Sue Grafton, yeah. She was doing the Alphabet series, and it was like,
oh,
she was literally working on the last.
Yeah.
Aww.
And like,
please tell me there's a ghostwriter that's publishing that.
No, sure. So, actually, her family, like, is respecting her wishes, and is, which we'll see how long they, like,
oh, want she specifically those... asked that it not be finished?
Yeah, something like that.
She
hadn't even started working on it, I think. Like, she was about to start or something along those lines.
One more in the series, and you're not going to let people release it, really?
I mean...
That sounds very much like, you know, in the biblical story. It was like, oh, you saved up all your money. Who will have it now? You'll die tonight. It's like she kind of tempted fate by creating the series that had a specific ending to get to.
Yeah, it's like, this is the day, the year you die. Anyway, total diversion.
We can cut that out. Yeah. That's fine.
Cut that.
Or move it.
Alright, so is there any, that, those were all my notes for it. Is there anything else anybody wanted to talk about?
I mean, like, there was maybe a little something about Vita and Yolson, if you really wanted to read into it,
if you really squint at it. Which, you know, like, as queer people, we are used to really squinting to find representation and things, so that's a fair point. I did a little bit think about that, especially considering at that point I thought that maybe Babadab was queer, so, but I was so distracted by Yolson's gross thing with Horza that it never really...
And that has been lesbian. Ah, fuck.
Been lesbian. That could actually be funny, and that has been lesbian.
Now, shut up, is in the corner while we finish.
The woman had her peace, let the men talk. And that leads us into feminism.
So that was Aaron's lesbian subtext corner. Thank you, Aaron.
And with that, we're going to bring our inaugural episode of Drunk Queer Bitches Talk Books to a close. Today's episode was part one of our discussion of Consider Phlebas by Ian M. Banks. Be on the lookout for part two, which should be available shortly. We'll finish our discussion of Consider Phlebas and let you know what book we'll be reading for our next episode. If you'd like to contact us, you can reach us at dqbtalkbooks@gmail.com, or you can find us on Facebook and our Twitter pages. Just search DQB Talk Books.
Join us next time when we have
a new book,
new stories,
and most importantly, new drinks.
Until next time, and please, read responsibly. Alright, now what are we doing? What's next?
Plot! You've got the gay agenda.
I do have the gay agenda.
Do you want a pen so you can, like, cross them
You've
out.
Got the gay agenda!
Like... Let me pull up
maybe not cross them out, because we'll use that as like an outline for next month. Mm-hmm. Like, it won't be exact, but maybe like a check mark next to what we've discussed.
Actually, take a picture of it.
Huh?
Cross it out. Did you not hear her?
What?
I said don't cross it out,
just put
actually.
Check marks, because we're going to use it as kind of a, I mean, that probably doesn't matter. I doubt we'll post that again, but.
Take a picture of the whole thing.
We're going to put that in our scrapbook.
We've got a pristine version. Before you check things.
What?
Take a picture of it.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Wait, didn't we get a picture last night?
Of the gay agenda, not
this
of the...
This podcast supported by the phrase, oh, for fuck's sake.
That's... I'm going to say that often, and...
And I will be editing most of that out.
Well, I might just sneak them in on you. So... In the middle of Aaron saying something very astute. Oh, for fuck's sake. Okay, we have
that
a picture
That was
going to
get left in, because that was gold.
It's getting hot in here. So take off all your clothes.
Oh, I did want to say this a little bit. Okay. While looking at the Goodreads page here, I noticed that the top review of this book actually comes from none other than Felicia Day. So I'm sure Ian M. Banks were alive today, he would be thrilled to learn that his book was thumbs up by the ingenue of Dr. Horrible Sing-Along Blog.
I met her. She drew tits in her book for me.
Did she?
Yes, she did. With her signature.
I was gonna say, I didn't like her in Dr. Horrible, but...
Well, that's because her character was not great.
Yeah.
I was about to say, she was an Anjanue. What do you expect?
Yeah, no, I got her to write in the phrase
behind. She was the love interest. Don't dress it up.
The Adventures of Link.
I said she was the love interest. Don't dress it up.
Right.
All right, so settings. Yep.
Oh.
Okay, so...
Wait, please finish chewing. Yes.
I'm sorry, I got distracted.
Famished.
Are we done?
Is this an acceptable time for an over fuck's sake?
Oh, for fuck's sake.
That is my word!
We should get it in unison, everybody. Oh, for fuck's sake.
Okay, are ready?
Back to the podcast.
Back to Sony.